The Lucas County Council Podcast is a co-production of WGTE Public Media and the Lucas County Council Program, with generous support from an Ohio Attorney General's Office grant award. More information at causakids.net.
Welcome to The Power of One, the Lucas County CASA podcast, where we explore how just one caring adult can make a life-changing difference for a child in the welfare system. I'm your host, Andrea de la Roca. In our first episode, we spoke with CASA staff attorney Mary Meadows about the findings of the Ohio CASA evaluation. The statewide study found that children with a CASA volunteer are almost four times more likely to be reunified with their families, 10 times more likely to find a permanent placement, and far less likely to re-enter foster care after leaving. The study also showed that CASA volunteers help children get more timely health care and give them a strong voice in the system. Today we'll focus on one of the most important and often misunderstood factors we cover in our training, the impact of poverty on children and families. Did you know that nearly 40% of children in Toledo live in poverty? That's 4 out of every 10 children in our community. Nationally, 1 in 6 children live below the poverty line. These aren't just numbers. This is the reality many of the children we serve face every day. To help us unpack this topic, I'm joined by CASA Director Chris Carrier. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you for having me. It's nice to be back.
Yes.
And to talk about this topic today.
Thank you. Before we dive into the impact of poverty on children and families specifically, I'd like to zoom out for a moment. Can you please walk us through what the pre-service training looks like here in our county?
Yes, absolutely. So the pre-service training is a 6-week course. We meet Wednesday evenings, typically, from 5:30 to 8:30 p.m. We provide dinner and dessert. So we always say, bring your appetites because it's really good. But what we do is we learn, the volunteers learn about a variety of topics such as child development, trauma, domestic violence, substance abuse, mental health issues. We teach them how to investigate a case from start to finish, who to talk to, how to talk to them, what type of documentation or records they need to get, how to get those records as well. We do in-person case studies so that they can practice those skills that we're teaching them in the investigation part of it. We do that as a group so they have other people that they can ping ideas off of. And the majority of the work is going to be done in class, but there is some online work that we ask the potential volunteers to do as well, such as readings, watching videos, commenting on, you know, what they've read or what they've watched. And that's pretty much.
Okay. What do you use for the online training?
It's Google Classroom.
Okay. And what if someone who really wants to volunteer doesn't feel comfortable with the technology?
If they don't feel comfortable with the technology, we are able to print what we would have put online for them to read. Now, there are some things, the videos, we obviously can't print those, but we can make accommodations for them to view those videos if they're not comfortable using the technology of the Google Classroom platform.
How does the training prepare volunteers for the realities of child advocacy work?
As I discussed, we have in-person case studies that we go over, but not only do we have those case studies that are predetermined, but we also talk about real cases that we've experienced at Lucas County Juvenile Court. And we don't sugarcoat. We tell the volunteers to be exactly what's going on in those cases, the issues that are at hand. We explain to them, you know, this is what mental health looks like, and here's how it came out in this case. This is what substance use looks like, and here's how it came out in that case. As far, you know, trauma, the same thing. And we also train on cultural differences, which is big for a lot of our volunteers, and then refraining from bias as well.
From what you just explained, it sounds like mental health issues, domestic violence? Is there another, like, typical themes that you see in the cases?
Yeah, it's, like you said, it's mental health, domestic violence, and the third one is substance use. And there's either one, two, or all three of those combined in a case.
Well, my name is Desiree Rayford, and I am a CASA. And what I do is that I make decisions that's in the best interest of the child. When the child is taken out of the home by LCCS, my responsibility is to go to the home and investigate to get the factual information as to why the child was taken out, as well as answer questions that the parent may have at that time. I've been a CASA for over a year, and what brought me to this journey is that it was something that I always wanted to do, but I was working at the time, and once I retired, I just went full force and decided I was going to take the class and I was going to go through the process to be a CASA. I think every story is a memorable story. Every event is a memorable event. Every situation is memorable. With that being said, I don't think any situation sits above the next one. It's so rewarding to go through the process with the parents as they have to go and satisfy the requirements of their case manager. And ultimately, you actually get to see and meet the family where they are, and then you get to see where they end up at. I just want to say CASA has just been a very positive experience for me, and I don't regret a day of being a CASA.
Chris, from your perspective, why is it so important that new volunteers understand themes such as poverty before stepping into a case?
It's really important that they understand that because the number of children living in poverty in Lucas County is so high. Volunteers need to understand how living in poverty can affect families and their specific needs. Although it's not a cause for abuse or neglect, poverty is considered a major risk factor for abuse. It itself places a lot of stress on families. Sometimes they're unable to cope, and they become isolated from resources. They face a variety of challenges, and then there's numerous problems that seem to just compound one another.
So the second section of our training materials highlights both the realities and the myths about poverty. One myth we hear a lot is, if you have a job, you can't be poor. But in fact, more than two-thirds of poor children have at least one working parent. What are some of the most common misconceptions CASA volunteers may have about families living in this situation?
That's a great question. And I don't think it's necessarily just CASA volunteers that would have the misconception. I think that it's across the United States would have the misconception of, people are lazy and they just don't want to work, or they don't know how to budget their money properly, or they just keep having too many kids. Other ones, they prefer to live this way. They bring the circumstances on themselves. And I know that we've heard before, well, the family has a big screen TV in their home, so how can they possibly be poor? So those are the common themes that we seem to hear a lot, and not just from our volunteers that are people that are going to be volunteers. It's across the board.
Okay. So if we hear those misconceptions, how do we help volunteers understand, is there a minimum standard for parents? Can you help the audience understand how we work with that misconception?
Yeah, absolutely. So there is a minimum standard, and it's called the minimum sufficient level of care. And everyone who's involved in the case is required by law to consider that specific standard. That standard states whether or not the child can remain in a home or whether they can return to the home. It's complicated, but it's determined by a number of factors, and those factors are not going to be the same for each family, and they're not going to be the same for each child in each family. It's not necessarily an ideal situation, but we have to look to see if the parent is able to provide at a basic level. And by basic level, I mean food, shelter, clothing, providing medical care, making sure there's no safety concerns in the home, making sure that the parent has protective capabilities. There's an emotional aspect to it. Is there a bond between the parent and the child? And for the child, him or herself, does that child have any specific academic needs or certain disabilities that the parent needs to tend to? So what we need to do is make sure that standard is in place. It's looked at, it's considered from the very beginning to the very end of the case. And we have to use that standard because it would protect from inputting our individual biases and value judgments on the family.
So there's like a guard to protect the children too.
Sure, absolutely, because no one will want to reunify if the home isn't safe, if the reasons why the child was removed in the first place have not been remedied.
You know, in your opinion, why are poor children more likely to come into contact with the child welfare system than children from middle or upper income families?
There's a variety of reasons why that happens. Middle and upper class families have access to more resources within their families, such as other people that they can financially count on to step in and help out when needed. But people in poverty have to turn to the system for support, accessing medical care or obtaining food stamps or even assistance with housing. So once that contact is initiated, families are communicating then with what we call mandated reporters. And that then increases the likelihood that issues of child abuse or neglect would be investigated.
So research tells us that poverty causes enormous stress, which can increase risk factors. What are some of the effects you've seen on children's health academically or emotionally? And if you can, you know, give us like an example of a case.
I can't give you a specific example of a case, but what research has told us and what we've just seen in a variety of cases is brain development, you know, happens early on, right, as the child is growing. And it really depicts the importance of the person's overall emotional and intellectual well-being. Well, children who are in poverty have a greater risk of impaired brain development because of their increased exposure to other risk factors, such as inadequate nutrition, parental substance abuse, maternal depression, exposure to environmental toxins, and that's usually because of where they're forced to live, and a low-quality daycare facility that the kids have to go to, and even teen pregnancy. So, although I can't give you a specific case, you know, like I said, poverty really shapes the context of each child's situation in some fashion. The majority of our families that we serve are low income. And again, it's not a reason for abuse. Poverty's not. But because of what I've previously discussed, it definitely is a risk factor.
It's eye-opening to hear how poverty intersects with child welfare. But as a CASA volunteer, we're not here to judge. We're here to understand and advocate.
Hello, my name is Addy Castillo, and I'm a new volunteer for CASA. So the application process was pretty straightforward, very simple, and they had a specific date for the deadline of when to apply, because they have a certain day they want to start the cohort. So because there are 6 weeks of training and they want to make sure that everybody has in their paperwork, their background checks, they're very, very thorough about who they allow to be a CASA. So, it was pretty easy though applying, and they made the background check application very simple. And the training was very eye-opening for me as well. You know, coming from a very stable home and going to school every day and having a very typical childhood, you know, learning about different backgrounds that people come from and different experiences that kids go through, even in the same neighborhood as me, you know, that was really interesting. So it was very informative though, and I enjoyed it. I'm a recent college graduate, and so I just had a bit of extra time on my hands, and I love learning. I love being a part of something greater than myself. And so I wanted to do something to volunteer my time aside from working. And I learned about CASA. I'd never heard of it until I think I saw an ad for it on social media somewhere. And I was like, what's this? And I read all about it, and it sounded like something I wanted to be a part of.
So let's get practical. For a new CASA volunteer walking into their first case, what are the best practices when working with families in this situation?
There are a lot of best practices. As it relates to poverty specifically, I would say find strength in the family and use that approach by acknowledging resources that exist within the family, as well as including extended family, and tap into those. So definitely finding strength within the family. We teach our volunteers to be how to use a resource lens, looking for positive aspects in the family rather than using a deficit lens where you look for negative aspects.
Okay, so you mentioned the importance of using a resource lens. What's an example of how a volunteer might apply that in real life?
How a volunteer would apply using the resource lens in real life. An example, let's see, listening to the parents talk, acknowledging their progress, you know, saying, great job, you got clean screens, or you've made so many sessions with your mental health provider. Tell me about some of the things that you've learned from your domestic violence classes. Just acknowledging that progress is helpful. Pointing out all the things that the parents have done while they're with their children is also great. Volunteers have the ability to observe parent and child interactions. So praising them on how well they worked with their child through these observations, you know, great job helping your child put his or her shoes on, or you effectively, you know, told your child no in a safe way. Avoid labeling them as well, encouraging them to keep up with their case plan, staying the course, and then I think creating options for them. So maybe if the child is in foster care, you can help them identify a relative placement, or if the parent mentions a past support system, encouraging them to reconnect with that support system.
Okay, so that's a great way to show empathy to mm-hmm. the parents, because the reality is, like, we all, the CASA volunteer, caseworkers, you know, we all in a same team. Our main focus is the best interest of the child. And at the beginning, that includes reunification. That's the first, you know, idea we have, right, for most of the cases.
It's always the goal. First, the goal is always reunification.
Yeah. So we want to be, you know, cheerleaders, let's say,
yeah,
for the parent, mm-hmm. whatever their issues are, that they will overcome that so that that way the child can go back.
Right.
What if that can be possible? In which ways can they show empathy towards the parent?
Clearly, the job of the CASA volunteer is to look to see what is in the best interest of the child. And if reunification is not possible, the CASA volunteer can still be empathetic to the parent in that position, if legal custody is being granted to a relative, let's say, the CASA volunteer can still make sure that the parents have a set schedule for visitation. So they are still in contact with their child and they're making sure that a relationship is still there as the child ages. It's difficult when it's not reunification because parents are pretty upset about that.
Communication is a big part of advocacy. What tips would you give for building trust with families who may already feel judged or misunderstood by the system?
I would tell them, be patient. The system is involved with the family now, right? CSB has removed their children. They now have all of these case plan services to complete. Caseworkers are coming to their home every month. There's multiple phone calls, and then CASA is just one more person that they have to deal with. It's going to take time for the parents to open up and trust. You have to be patient. They have maybe been mistreated by other systems in the past, and so they're going to be a little leery of anybody else digging into their business. That would be the first tip, I would say. The second thing is get to know them. Get to know the parents. It's not our place to interject our own personal beliefs, values, or feelings on any parent. We've not walked in their shoes. We don't know what their past is like. We don't know what they're truly going through. So get to know them. Past, present, future, all of that. It's very important. And then the third thing I would say is listen. Let them talk. This is about them. This isn't about you. It's about what they're experiencing. And sometimes you are just their sounding board. They're not angry at you. They're angry at maybe children's services, or they're angry at their therapist that they just don't get along with. So just listen to them and let them talk.
These best practices remind us that advocacy is about both clarity and compassion. The way we frame what we see can make a lasting difference. Chris, thank you for offering your insights today and for your ongoing commitment to protecting and advocating for children in Lucas County. Today, we have learned that poverty itself is no abuse, but it can create great stress that puts families at risk. What makes the CASA role unique is that volunteers are trained to see the difference between poverty and neglect, to recognize families' strengths, and to advocate for resources that help children grow up safe and supported. I'd like to leave you with this thought. When we look at families, we can choose to focus only on problems, or we can also look to strengths and possibilities. That shift in perspective can change a child's story. If today's conversation inspires you and you'd like to learn more about becoming a CASA volunteer, please visit CASAKids.net or call us at 419-213-6753. Be sure to join us for episode 3, where we will talk about the role of the CASA volunteer in a child's health journey. Thank you for listening to Lucas County CASA Podcast, The Power of One.
The Lucas County CASA Podcast highlights how the power of one person can transform the lives of abused children in our community. This podcast is a co-production of WGTE Public Media and the Lucas County CASA Program, with generous support from an Ohio Attorney General's Office grant award. All episodes are posted on WGTE.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Learn more about the Lucas County CASA Program at CASAKids.net.